Welcome to episode 11 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver. I'm a filmmaker and a podcast host and adventure seeker and the director of the groundbreaking film PTSD 911. Thanks for joining us today on the show. My guest today is Mike Ming. Mike began his distinguished firefighting career as a volunteer in his hometown of Forestville, California in 1991. He worked as a seasonal firefighter for Cal Fire for a number of years and then went full-time in 1998 and became a permanent employee in 2000. Mike worked in a number of key positions in his career at Cal Fire, including as a captain on the Elite Aviation Unit. In 2020, he promoted to Staff Chief, Program Manager of the newly branded Behavioral Health and Wellness Program. Mike had a part in the PTSD 911 documentary, and he has since retired from Cal Fire and is enjoying life outside of the fire service. Stay tuned for my conversation with Mike as he talks about the steps he took to prepare for his retirement. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to the podcast. And if you think others would too, please subscribe and share. That helps us get the word out to others. And if you have some time, leave a review. Let me know how the podcast is doing. Today's show is brought to you by PTSD 911, the documentary film. If you're looking for a resource to get your officers, your dispatchers, your firefighters talking about wellness and mental health, order PTSD 911 for your agency. Visit PTSD911movie.com and use the coupon code SAVE25 now to save 25% on your purchase. That's PTSD911movie.com. Coupon code SAVE25 now. And we'll send you the film and digital toolkit for your agency, and you can start watching it and using it in your training right away. And now here's my interview with Mike Ming. Well, Mike, welcome to the First Responder Wellness Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is wonderful.
Yeah, I really, I've learned to appreciate you and what you do. You and Sequoia came up to out to the West Coast for the launch of our Coast to Coast bike ride. But not only did you come to the West Coast, you came to the East Coast for our return at Ocean City. So I want to say thank you for that.
Well, it was our pleasure. It was really fun. Yes, it was. And it was inspiring to see what you were doing. I mean, that's really what led us to jump in with you and support you as much as possible, because what you're doing, and I've told you this, is very sacred, very sacred work, diving into this particular arena. So thank you.
Yeah, well, it's my privilege and my honor to do this work and now this podcast and what we're doing to kind of continue that conversation that the film has stirred up in me. Now I'm kind of working to continue that conversation through these interviews and through the podcast that we're doing. So speaking of that, so tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into the fire service? Why did you get into the fire service? Can you tell us that?
Yeah. I think it basically points to my older brother, Max. I remember as a teenager, we shared a room, and he was a volunteer firefighter in our hometown. And he would get up at night. He had this giant VCR looking Plectron, it was called, and it would go off and he would jump up and he would respond to the station. And at that point, I started getting the adrenaline and the cortisol dumps. So I was like, oh, what's going on? What's happening? And so I basically followed in his footsteps. And when I was able to, when I lived within the district, I started to volunteer. That was 1991. I volunteered in our hometown. From there, I was also playing baseball. I thought perhaps I was going to be a ball player, and I was pre-med during that time. But my heart was just falling straight into fire. And I couldn't stop thinking about it when I was studying and when I was on the ball field. I just always wanted to run calls because I was a volunteer and I got the bug. So I just pursued that. I dropped basically everything, got a degree, but I dropped everything and I started volunteering in my hometown. And in that, there was a search for that permanent job, which we all wanted. And so we would take classes and things and also volunteer and do our best to find that permanent job as a firefighter. I eventually found a seasonal job in 1994. Through 98, I was seasonal. until I was full time. And then in 2000, I became a permanent employee. Backing up to 91, one of the things that kind of formed my person, who I was as a firefighter, who I was as a leader eventually. I think we're all leaders, by the way, individually, and it comes down to the individual in every moment. But I was exposed to a critical incident. I wasn't on the call itself, but I was able to, and we wouldn't do this these days, is allow outsiders in, but I was able to sit in on a critical incident stress debriefing. And I sat as a young man, and I watched my older mentors, the people who taught us how to fight fire and extricate, you know, structure fire, wildland fire, medical aids, you know, vehicle accidents, hazardous materials, all the things, these tough, you know, basically hicks, I'm going to say that because we're, you know, country. That was very impressionable upon me because I watched them break down. It was a very traumatic call involving a death of a young child. And I saw that there was an association. They'd seen stuff before, but it was really interesting to me, and it molded me, that my tough mentors went around the room and they all broke down. And that was the first time I saw the association that comes with the trauma we're exposed to, and how it affects us and how it relates to our own family, because they had young children, happened to be a young girl, of their own, and they couldn't necessarily separate that. They couldn't think, these are my words, they couldn't necessarily think that this was not my child, as it were. So moving forward into my career, I always carried that with me. I did as much training as possible, and I told myself, if I'm going to get into this, I better pay attention to this particular aspect. Yeah, the fighting fire, the operations, the whole camaraderie is one thing. But there's this other side of it, this emotional, psychological side of it that I was exposed to very early, that I've always carried throughout my career.
You wonder what it was within you, within your background, in your training, maybe your family, you know, that caused you to be aware of that, to kind of say, hey, this is something I need to pay attention to.
So I've often thought about that. And I think, to the best of my ability, I come up with, it was so impactful. It was such an impact to watch these tough, they were all men, they're these tough men, break down like that. And I'd never seen that. I mean, these were men that played with my father in softball. I grew up with them. And so I never saw this side of it. And so that really, for some reason, I paid attention, and I don't really know why, but I was in school and I was studying and I was reading and, you know, discovering spirituality, things of that nature. And it just really had a giant impact on me. And for some reason it snapped right there. And I said, okay, I'm going to set this course to try and remember about this and to try to, if exposed to those types of things, do what I can to mitigate any type of emotional, psychological response. And that would carry me through to, you know, I would eventually retire out of that program.
So. Yeah. So fast forwarding in your life, you know, working with Cal Fire, and you guys had an opportunity to develop a program for the agency. How did that come about, and what did you do?
So I was operational. So kind of go back a little bit. I was operational. I was a wildland firefighter, type 3 engines. I was also a structural firefighter vehicle. You know, so it was an all hazard scenario. Cal Fire is not only wildland firefighter, but they're all hazard. So contracts with counties and things of that nature. So I was operational, but I always had this in the back of my mind about, when I was exposed to those things, I feel like I almost died a few times. And so that's very impactful on a person. And so I always had that thread in me. And so eventually when I was working off of a helicopter, as a captain, and then, then all of a sudden I wasn't, and I won't get too far into that, but, that was pretty devastating. And then, so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to focus on this area I wanted to promote. And then this program, that was called Employee Support Services, that started about 99, 2000 with one person. And then about 2004, there was two people, happened to be my partner, where I was permanent, who went over to the program. And so there was two people. And then by 2012, they were starting to build out the program a little more. And then by 2014, I actually promoted as a battalion chief into the program. And there was five people. There was a deputy chief, three battalion chiefs, and one administrative or non-uniform person. So I walked into a program that was established. We started building from there. As a battalion chief, I started out as the substance abuse assistance program coordinator for the state, where I would help folks get into recovery. This program's all voluntary. It's completely confidential. Mm-hmm. Eventually we would help, pass a law called AB 1116 and then also SB 542, presumptive PTSD. So that's a little bit later, but, the original push into that, I was a battalion chief and I was just, you know, covering a helpline, traveling around the state, having confidential conversations with folks, getting them into recovery or into PTSD retreats. There was really only kind of one or two at the time. And so we worked through that. And then eventually my deputy chief, had retired. And a new one came on. And then so we worked with him. And then when he retired, I went for that job as a deputy chief and I got it. So I became the program manager, deputy chief program manager of this program, which was called Employee Support Services. Now, it wasn't a permanently funded program as far as the budget was concerned. It was executive support. Basically, the director, Chief Pimlott, the retired director, kind of was his baby, and he pushed it forward, and he had great support. And before he retired, I was working basically for him, but through HR. So my boss was the HR chief. He was inspirational, and he had a bunch of support. And then the new director came in behind him, and they tasked me with writing a budget change proposal so we could get a permanent funding source, which would be permanent fund in the general fund of Cal Fire coming from state government. And in that, building out more positions and that permanent funding. So I took a lot of my life away trying to write that. Here's an operational guy coming in and in this environment that is Sacramento, as you can imagine, there's a steep learning curve as to how things go, what things do, what are control agencies, what happens, you know. And so with the executive support and then the close contact with the governor's office and legislature, I pushed this budget change proposal through. It wasn't just me. There's no me in leadership. There's only we. But the leader has the accountability, the liability, the authority, you know, all of that stuff. So we pushed through a budget change proposal with executive support. That was the key. And it was successful. Mm-hmm. It was successful. We had a permanent funded budget. And then we grew to 27 positions, permanent positions from five that were basically not permanent. They were just pieced together. And from there, we rebranded the Employee Support Services to the Behavioral Health and Wellness Program. And I got to say, I mean, I'm retired and I'm not quite following it. I'm kind of disconnected. So they could rebrand. They could be doing different things at this point. I'm not really up to speed, but this is just my experience. And so with the budget change proposal being successful, the 27 programs, we started hiring a bunch of people. And it wasn't necessarily something that everybody was jumping into. Mm-hmm. I felt it. I was like, this is important based on the 91 experience, right? But not a lot of people were like just beating on the door to get into it. There were a couple and they're in the program now. So we had to screen folks. We had to really find out who was good fits, but we also had to follow all the rules of control agencies, CalHR, you know, that type of thing as far as hiring. Mm-hmm. You got it merit-based. So that was a challenge. And eventually we would get to 27 permanent folks. And we had two components of it. Basically, there was the wellness unit, which is physical fitness, nutrition, and cancer awareness, a group of folks, just outstanding individuals. And then the ESS unit, which was kind of separated into the operational side, which was uniformed folks, basically battalion chiefs and deputy chief. And eventually I would be a staff chief, right, from the new positions. And then the administrative staff, which is kind of non-uniform, but it's the administrative staff that worked with the, there's a ton of folks. There are a ton of folks in all throughout the state that make Cal Fire run, and they're administrators and they're kind of in the back seat. Yeah, you see the planes, you see all these things, but there's some administrators back there and everybody has the stressors. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter who you are. As human beings moving through life, there's stressors. Mm-hmm. So we had those particular groups moving throughout the field, doing trainings, doing curriculum development through our CFTC in coordination with the folks, the chiefs out there who wanted to implement a wellness, and they had their own wellness unit, but we worked with those folks. And so we got to the training center in concert with those folks, and we implemented this program, this awareness, eventually the PPTs that you actually show in your film, that was crucial because we wanted to get to people early with this information and knowledge. Mm-hmm. So they were armed themselves to go throughout their career and hopefully retire happy.
Mm-hmm. So for those who don't really know or understand Cal Fire, give us kind of a big picture. How many people work for Cal Fire? What do you guys do across the state and that kind of thing? And so this group of 27 is serving this larger group.
Yes, about 8,000, 8,500 at peak staffing along the way. They've since approved some staffing increases. And I believe, don't quote me, but I believe it's somewhere going to be around 10,000, 11,000 folks, mm-hmm. both operational, admin, and administrative. And so there's, it's the state of California. Mm-hmm. We are California's fire department. And historically, it was born out of protecting the forest lands, because the forest land, the wood and all that stuff was California's economy way back. I'm talking about way back. And they wanted to put the fires out in order to protect their resource, which was income for the general fund for California. So there's 21 different geographical units. Most of them have couple counties or several parts of several counties, or just to make it easy, there's one county that is a geographical unit. And there's 21 unit chiefs throughout the state that are running those particular units, right? And so within those units, they have wildland responsibilities, 31 million acres in California that are statutory responsibility to protect. Those encroach upon municipals, cities, and in counties. And so there's a lot of population within there. There's also federal lands that are within California, and there's coordination there. So Cal Fire not only is a wildland firefighting agency, from history. We have the finest aviation force, we believe, and a lot of people around the world who want to model us aviation force in the world. We have ground troops. We call it iron. So there's engines, there's dozers, there's crews, you know, the crew buggies that show up with a bunch of folks. There's a state fire marshal is a part of that. But within these particular counties, there could be contracts with those counties to be the fire department. So it's not only wildland fire, but there's certain contract counties that, like, let's say, for example, LA County, the state gives LA County funds to protect the wildlands. So those aren't employees, but in other counties, Cal Fire is the fire department. So it's all hazard fire department. And so this very dynamic Cal Fire is, it's the aviation, the ground resources, and then when major incidents occur, obviously wildland fires, but earthquakes, train derailments, anything that's largely impactful to our culture and our society, we have incident command teams that are called upon. Forest Service Federals, they have those as well, but they're primarily looking at the wildland fire. So we have incident command teams that come in, and we set up our are little cities in close to these incidents, and then it's full of finance, logistics, operations planning. It's a command and general staff, so the incident commander is in charge, but there's all these folks, and so we go out there and we mitigate the incidents the best we can. So it's an all hazard fire department. It's born out of wildland, and it was a fascinating department to work for because there was multiple opportunities to do a lot of things.
How is trauma or incidents, I mean, how are they different from like structure fires or accidents versus some kind of wildland incident? How are they the same? How are they different, those kind of incidents? As far as the kind of visceral response for the people on the ground, you know, what they're experiencing.
Yeah. So there's individual threat. So wildland firefighting, like I said, I almost died a few times. There were some very close calls. And so there was, and I was younger, so I didn't know it affected me so much. Right. So, there's the individual threat to personal safety and crew safety. So that's one arena where you think you might die. Mm. And we're going into a very hazardous, very dangerous situation with training, with our head up in mindfulness, you know, and making sure that we're making the proper decisions and doing those things. Yet we're also exposed to medical aids, vehicle accidents, structure fires, deaths of many different types, suicides. And so when you walk into an environment and you're exposed to, let's say, a household with a suicide completion, that is hugely impactful. And originally, basically, they said, suck it up, buttercup. This is what we do. Mm-hmm. I was told to pull up my skirt, which is neat. That was really fun. Don't cancel me. I'm quoting everything. Just, these are all quotes. And so when you walk into an environment where there's this visceral, emotional family based on a loved one's passing, that personally impacted me much more. Mm-hmm. Absolutely much more. So our brains, from a lot of smart people who had talked to me and my readings over the decade that I was in the program, our brains really can't separate necessarily. Amygdala, hippocampus, prefrontal cortex can't really necessarily separate that's not our, the association, that's not our child, or that's not me, right? And so we, it's kind of like a snake bite in the dark. Like it kind of comes out eventually because we see all these calls, there's a backpack. A proverbial backpack. This is a call. And it eventually gets heavy and we're trudging through life. And it could be just one tiny little pebble that gets in there that'll bring you down, to use an analogy. Mm-hmm. So the difference is in wildland firefighting, there's a lot of nature. There's a destruction. I mean, the Paradise Fire, it was the same thing that I just alluded to with medical aids and structure fires and vehicle accidents, because we saw whole towns. Sure. Destroyed. We had employees that had lived there, retired employees. We had, there was CHPs, there was sheriffs, there was a lot of first responders in that community that, brothers and sisters, that their town and their community was destroyed. And so it's very impactful. So across the board, just to summarize, the traumas and grief that we're exposed to enter us no matter what we are doing. And there's less of it in wildland firefighting, except for the past several years because of the destruction and the deaths and the infernos that we have seen, versus you're going to medical aids in a city every day and structure fires, and you're within a lot of the community and seeing them. I hope that.
Yeah.
Suffice.
Yeah, and I know that just from things I've read and heard that some of these fires, like Paradise Fire, you know, not only do you have the destruction of the buildings and homes, but then you have in the midst you have bodies that are there, and what I've been told is just the smell of death is in the air, and I'm sure that's got to have an impact.
Absolutely. So our olfactory nerves, you know, the body keeps the score, right? So when you see something, you feel something, you hear something, you smell something, you taste something, if it's associated with trauma, it doesn't leave. Your body says, oh, this is a threat, and stores it for the next time it comes up, and then you're right back to it. So the smell of bodies either decomposed or burning is not anything that anybody needs to experience, except it's just part of the job. So that those things are triggers, and they are large in part a part of the unconscious snake bite in the dark that comes up when in us. For example, I can smell a certain grass that's cured in the hills where I live, and it reminds me of my childhood. Like it's just like I'm right back to my childhood. So when you see these things on TV and you've actually, if you're watching TV or the news and you've actually experienced it, you can actually smell it. It comes right back. So those types of things, those triggers, stay with us, and it's just our job to process them, become friends with them, and be able to live with them.
So what did you guys do in your program, and what did Cal Fire do to help mitigate the results of those things with your employees?
So we had several programs, distinct programs. I think that the biggest impact that I was pushing was that training to firefighters and administrative staff, first day folks, and their families, because it's not just the employees.
It's an important
to come
piece.
Along. For
Such an important.
It's
piece.
A huge piece.
Yeah.
If you miss that, you're remiss in what your process is. So. The early education information and training to folks, so new folks, so they're set up for the rest of their career, but additional training for folks like myself who were trained to suck it up, that are, you know, firefighters, engineers, captains, chiefs that have 30 years on the job that are kind of jaded, still trying to reach out to those folks to educate them about this process and this system, because I believe it is the number one thing to keep us happy and healthy is to know this, and then we can teach you to fight fire, right? So we get to them early, we get to the folks who haven't had the training, so we develop these programs. We had a peer support program. I wrote them down because I'm just flushing stuff as we have a peer support program, which we trained peers and units with different types of training that are associative to critical incidents and what to do and recoveries and PTSD and sleep depth and suicidal ideation, those types of things. And so we would train them up, and we would use those folks because we would have peer support. When requested, we would have peer support at incidents for folks to come off the line. So you got to get to them right away in order to process that. We had an employee assistance program. We are managers of that. And so we sought out culturally competent clinicians, which I know you're aware of. The people that are licensed therapists or are PsyDs or psychologists that are working with first responders that either were first responders themselves and then got their degrees or in licensure. Because they can speak the language, because it's very important when somebody who has been stigmatized all these years that if you reach out for help, it's weak, which is not true. As soon as you reach out for help, when you feel like your backpack's too heavy, if you don't have somebody receiving you on the other end that speaks this culture, it'll shut the door right away. Mm-hmm. So the employee assistance program that we had a critical incident stress management is just a tool. It's just a tool, and you can pull it out when necessary. There's different levels of it. And not everybody can do that one. That one takes a special person to be able to show up with humility and listen, and then just follow the guidelines. Again, we had the administration and the family component of it. We reached out to families. We had family, I'm slipping my mind. The family retreats or sessions to where we inform the family, tell them exactly what their person is doing. And then we had the wellness units, which is the physical fitness and the ESS unit components, all of that. So I'm kind of losing my train of thought. So refresh me.
So one thing I want to say, I love what you guys are doing. I got to visit the training center up in Ione, and Chief Wheatley was, I think he was in charge there. And I was there for a train the trainer where we brought in a yoga instructor that was training, you know, chiefs, battalion chiefs. I'm not sure who all the people were in the room, but then they would go back to their individual places and train people locally. And I thought that was just fascinating how this is an initiative that you guys do to teach yoga to some of these, you know, people that probably like yoga. I thought that was like for, you know, soccer moms, you know?
Right. Which is exactly. So yeah, Chief Wheatley was a division chief, assistant chief out there. And he was kind of heading up the wellness program at the CFTC. And actually he got the job that I left, the staff chief of the program now. So Chief Wheatley's now the staff chief.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'll have to send him a text and say something to him.
So, yeah. Reach out to him. I'm sure he's busy. Sure. I'm sure he, yeah. So my own experience, I can tell, reach out to him. So the yoga, we did a lot of studies, talked to a lot of people. As you see in the film, if you've seen the folks that have seen the film, I allude to breathing, meditation, mindfulness, yoga as certain individual things that we can do to help mitigate the exposures to these trauma and the grief that we have. And these are scientifically backed, and it's getting more and more and more. So the yoga not only increases the tidal volume and your flexibility, but that process is related to realigning our central nervous systems. So when we get exposed to trauma, there's the amygdala, which is our basic instinct of fight or flight. Then the hippocampus is the neural pathways that go up that create the information for the fight or flight to our executive center, the prefrontal cortex. Now, when all of that is firing and firing and firing, it affects our HPA axis, the hypothalamus, pituitary, and our adrenal glands, all the chemical dumps, everything. And so our body is toxic and offline if we don't flush it. Yoga is one of those things that gets down to the central nervous system to help realign and flush it, along with physical exercise and eating nutritionally properly, if that's even a phrase. The yoga, when we introduce that, or the even breathing techniques, like it was so interesting. As a staff chief, I would stand up sometimes in front of the training center folks who were going through the new students. And for me to stand up there and say, yeah, I breathe, I meditate, I do yoga, that was one thing. So modeling the behavior and leadership. But really sometimes it took saying, you know, the Navy SEALs do this. They do combat breathing or box breathing, or they do this yoga. They know how it affects their bodies and what they can do to continue to perform at this high level. So the yoga that you had experienced there was the first implementation. Now, not everybody's on board with yoga,
because
we all come from different backgrounds, and everybody's got their opinion. Everybody's an expert in some things. So you don't have to do it. But what we're saying is it's scientifically backed to help you realign your central nervous system, get your emotional, psychological, and your physical components and bodies back in line to be happier and healthier. So that's the breathing, you know, just really oxygenating the brain. And the mindfulness or the meditation is those two kind of are in the same thing. I mean, I talk about it in your film, so I describe it in your film, but it's the meditation is just being aware that our thoughts and our anxieties and regrets are constantly pulling us away from right now. And the mindfulness is just being able to go, wow, I'm out of myself right now. So I need to be right back here to make this important decision, especially when we're in operational mode, right? And so the yoga is just another thing. And then there were myriad other techniques, more professional techniques and modalities that we would use with the culturally competent clinicians.
Yeah, I just found it, you know, fascinating that this was happening. And then I guess it's also something you guys teach for the new recruits and for the, because the class I was at, these people were seasoned veteran firefighters, leaders and within Cal Fire, but you guys bring it to the academy as well, to the new recruits.
Yeah. So those folks that you were with, we train the trainer. It's exactly what you said. So a nucleus, and then they go out across this giant state and then they start training, and it's just, you know, it's just a concept that works. Yeah.
That's awesome. So let me ask you personally, in your journey, how did how did learning these things help you manage that, those things in your own life?
Well, the jury's still out on that one, Conrad. I believe this. Nobody is perfect, sure. And we all are fallible human beings. However, in 1991, when I was exposed to that critical incident and watched my mentors, that set the tone. Mm-hmm. And then in my spiritual encounters, just as an individual, you know, comparative religions, looking at all the world's religions and what's, you know, asking the big questions for me, I found that, and just my opinion, so again, no canceling, that all of the world's religions are separated by language and geography. However, and I apologize to anybody that doesn't believe this, but this is my belief. We're all one, and then we just all are looking for happy, healthy, kind, loving communities, respectful of each other. And I think that's truly where the spirituality, I'm going to call it spirituality, comes from. I found that Buddhism was more closely associated with my mindset of the ocean and the forest and ironically the fire and the water and the dichotomous arena there. That is my spiritual ground, is the ocean, the lakes, the water, the cold water, the forests, as you could mm-hmm. see, just the exploration of nature and basically primitive skills. I do primitive skills, survival skills, that type of thing. It's how Sequoia and I got together. And so those particular things on a daily basis, waking up and saying to yourself, okay, let's do this, and having that mindfulness mindset. So we train our mind to be able to stay aware of the past and our exposures, not only like to in professional, but on our relationships, and not run from it, but face it and process it. And meditation really, and to come back full circle, meditation really allowed me to be aware of those things. And then ironically, fast forward, now we're, you know, to the end of my career, we're teaching it in as a tool for our folks. And so that meditation process really, I believe, carried me. It kept me somewhat sane. But again, I'm fallible. I have made major mistakes, both personally and professionally. And we don't necessarily dwell on that. But we don't just forget about it. But we pick ourselves up and we move forward. And so those particular tools that we just alluded to, those are things that I use, not on a daily basis. I could be better. those are tools that I could use. Now, the other thing is aside from the nature and submerging into the icy waters and surfing and things of that nature, it is family. Mm. It is community for me. To have loving support of my partner, of my two daughters, watching them grow and us growing together. And now that I'm retired, having the time to be able to spend more time with them and just the community, that the small community that I live in, this just the wonderful people that we're around, that's what fills me up daily. I wake up to the redwoods. I have wonderful, loving family. The physical exercise, we got great hikes around here. We got an ocean not too far away. We've got rivers and lakes not too far away, and forests not too far away, that I basically jump into and expose my body, my spirit, my mind to, and just in the awe of it all. So I'm great. I told you I almost died a few times, and that's true. That's true. I felt like my life was on the line a few times, if not mm-hmm. several. And so I wake up every morning grateful with this mindset, with the experiences that I've had and the work that I've done with meditation and the mindfulness awareness. And I'm thankful. I'm thankful and grateful that I get to breathe another day and witness my daughters and their life and my community. And I do that with my partner and having a good solid partner that is open, honest, communicative, and able to fall on their own sword, as I will too, in mistakes in relationships, that constant process of looking at yourself in the mirror in an honest look, again, not perfect, but an honest look and say, okay, I could use some work here. But just trying to be as positive as one can be in every moment is basically kind of what I got.
That's awesome. And I you alluded to that you have retired. I know a lot of people, when they retire, their wheels fall off, and you know, they go sideways. So what's that process been like for you, and how do you not lose that identity as a firefighter and now into your retirement years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was exposed to, and this is goes back to, why did you pay attention to the CISM? For some reason, I paid attention to older mentors of mine that were, I'm just going to use the one classification, old crusty captains. And they can teach you about fighting fire and things. And that's what they were. They were a captain firefighter. And I watched them retire. And this is why we had working on in the program, we're working on retirees. Like, we cannot forget about them. Sure. So I watched them retire and the wheels fall off, as you say. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. I don't want to do that. So, and for some reason also originally, my identity never really was a firefighter. Very proud, very happy, honored, absolutely honored to be a firefighter, an EMT, you know, serving, in service to our community. Absolutely very proud of that. But I also had this other, for some reason, I had this other thing that was like, well, that's a job that I'm honored to do that helps pay and feed my family and put shelter, but I've got all these other things that I want to do. So it was from the beginning, really, I saw, and throughout my career, I saw that, okay, I don't want to fall off the cliff when I do pull the pin. So it was an exercise throughout my entire career. Now, towards the end of my career, I started preparing. I'm saying 5 years. So I'm like, okay, 5 years out. So what am I going to do? A good friend of mine, retired battalion chief out of San Jose, he said, well, in the 2 years before you retire, he's like, if you want to do this thing when you retire, start doing it now. So it's a seamless transition into it, you know? And so I took that advice as well. However, the one thing, I think, Conrad, that I absolutely think has ushered me into being grateful for a profession and honored that I can just drop is because it took me away from my family. And it took a lot of my time. I mean, we would be deployed on, as you well know, like for days, months, you know, that's not always the case, months, you know, because you got to get rest cycle. But I'm done. I'm good. I experienced that. Mm-hmm. And again, the jury's still out on whether or not I came out unscathed. I know I didn't. But that's my process. And that's what the program offered me, was that deep dive into, okay, what's going on? And so that parallel, that program going into retirement, it was a blessing, really, to be a part of that program. And it kind of just ushered me out the door, and I was set up. I was set up emotionally and psychologically and physically, knowing these things that I need to do. And so I was ready to go. And I won't get into a lot of the politics and things, but it's a crazy world out there. And then you have movement all the time. And so the support ebbs and flows on anything that anybody's doing. And especially in programs that are relatively new, 99, but the permanent program and the build out of the program and the support that goes on there. I was tired. Mm-hmm. I gotta admit, I was tired. It was exhausting. I was honored. I feel very proud of what we as a group did with executive support and what we pushed forward. But it was time. And there was no doubt in my mind that when I, you know, because of our formula, retirement formula, when I turned 50, January 20, that was it. That was it. And I say thank you to my department that I had worked for. And I say thank you to my program, the people that I was leading that I worked for, that mindset. I do, it's cliche, but I do miss the good, contacts and people that I was exposed to. And yet I don't miss the operations of the thing. I was a helitac captain fighting fire off of a helicopter. And for me, that was the bee's knees. That was it. And I got to experience that. I was grateful and I'm honored to be able to, they pointed to me and said, yeah, go ahead and go for that. And I became a helicopter, private helicopter pilot because of it and these things. And that was my operational firefighting experience. That was the top of things. And I got to experience it. And again, almost died. And so I'm grateful I came out unscathed in that way. And I'm grateful for all the experiences and the people I worked with in the past. But it's time to find my own true identity. Outside of the confines of that profession.
Well, I think you've done a great job in that transition, just from my limited perspective and what you're doing. And I also like, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I know you do some kind of photography with mushrooms or something like that, or things you find in nature.
Oh, yeah. So this is part of that nature connection. So about 20 years now, I got this bug. We've got some great wild mushroom hunting areas around my area. And I got this bug. I started looking at them like, oh, what are these? What is a mushroom? You know, I never liked them as a child. But then once I started getting exposed to folks that were teaching me, and I got this little book and I was starting to read it. It's a great book. And I started looking at like Paul Stamets, these mycologists that are really pushing the mushroom. And I started, you know, researching it a lot more. And what I found is that the mushroom world, the mycelial world, is amazing. And it predates us, whatever your beliefs are. It predates us. And these things are fantastic and so fascinating. And I started taking pictures. I would take my little phone and I would just crawl like on my belly like a lizard. And I would just find these mushrooms. And then I would look at them and I would key them out. And I would wonder, what is it and what does it do? Is it going to kill me? You know, there's a handful that can, it'll destroy your liver. Is it medicinal? Is it a good food? What kind of proteins? And then there's all these other ones, like, you know, because there's psychedelic mushrooms out there. So you got to know what you're doing. Sure. Otherwise, you're going to die. You're going to go on some crazy trip that you never wanted to be on. Or you know, what you need to do is really look at those things. And that's what I've done, is I've dove into it. So whenever the rain comes, you'll find me in the forest on my belly, certain spots, picking those ones that I absolutely know and I absolutely love, eating the wild mushrooms from the forest. Yeah. So I love it. And my partner loves it. My daughters love it. And so it's just it's a fascinating world to dive into. And that's what I'm doing now, is diving into those particular worlds, you know, that I love and I have.
That's awesome. Well, next time I come out there, and it may not be too far away, well, you'll have to take me out to the woods, see if we can find some of those.
Absolutely.
I think that would be fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we got the rain promises the mushrooms. And so there's certain times for certain substrates, certain species. And so we'll have to go exploring no matter what. So
for sure. I know we're working on a screening event down in the Bay Area. So I'm not sure when that's going to be. It's probably sometime January, February timeframe. So
we'll great. That there should be some mushrooms in that time.
We'll have to stay in touch. Well, Mike, it's been a real privilege having you on the program, and just, I know your journey has been amazing and the work you've done has been amazing. Congratulations on that. Congratulations on your retirement. And I know you got some fun things planned. So my question to all my guests is, what's something fun you're doing in the next month?
In this next month?
Next month or two, yeah.
So I'm going to be traveling south on the California coast to hang out with some of my best friends in the world, family that when I was a snowcat operator in Kirkwood, when I was a seasonal, I ran into my friend Marty, and I'm going to go down. I haven't seen them in a long time, and I really want to go spend time with them. And then my in-laws have a house on the beach down there. I might stay there if it's available. I'm thinking of traveling, doing some camping by myself, either north or south, and check out some surf spots, some camping spots. And then we will be going to watch a friend of ours who plays in the NFL. We're going to be traveling across the country and hanging out with them, watching a game. And then I will be going to Costa Rica for a month in late November. Sequoia will join me. And then I'm going to fly my daughter out for her 20th birthday, which is December 20, and we'll be coming back on that day, but I'll spend 10 days with my daughter down in Costa Rica, which I've never been and I want to explore. So those are kind of fun things that are happening in the next few
months. That's awesome. Well, Mike, thank you again for being on the program. Thank you for your contribution to the film and your work there. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the very best in all that you do.
I appreciate you, Conrad. You're doing sacred work. Thank you. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Say hello to John and family. And we need to continue this conversation. And Conrad, you're the tip of that. And I appreciate you very much, sir. And I love you. Hope that's not too much, but we've gotten to know each other. I'm grateful for you and your family and all of your people that you're touching. And I'm very proud, happy, and honored to have done what I've done. It's time to move on, and I can't wait to continue this journey with you and spread that word with you. So I appreciate you. Thank you for having me on.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Mike, for being a good friend and for your support of the work we're doing with PTSD 911. I really appreciate you. And thanks to you for listening to the show. I appreciate it. Please leave a review and give it 5 stars if you think it's worth it. And please subscribe to the show. Also, just a reminder that you can see the video of this content on our Patreon channel. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can get access to that. We want others to discover this content and benefit from it as well. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where to turn, you can dial 988 for help. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.